Welcome to Two Teas in a Pod. I'm Kate Diaz, a Manchester math teacher and elected president of CEA, the Connecticut Education Association. We are Connecticut's largest teachers union, representing tens of thousands of professional educators across the state.
And I'm Jocelyn Delancey, a fifth grade teacher in Darien, elected vice president of CEA and president of CEF, the Connecticut Education Foundation, CEA's charitable arm.
In every episode, you'll hear thought-provoking interviews, as well as actionable tips and strategies that you can implement in your daily life. We'll have stimulating discussions to help you become a more informed, an effective educator, and advocate for your students and the teaching profession.
Thanks for spending some time with us today. Now let's jump right into Two Teas in a Pod.
Jocelyn, we are excited today. We are joined by a little bit of our local celebrity. Senator Marty Looney is joining us, who is the Senate president. So this is kind of exciting for us because there is so much happening at the Capitol right now and many, many things that our members are interested in. So thank you so much for joining us, Senator.
Oh, it's great to be with you this afternoon. This is a busy time in this session because it's a short session, of course, in the even year. But this year, because of the calendar, it is just about the shortest possible short sessions because of the late starting date, February 9th, and the early end date, May 4th, because we start the first Wednesday after the first Monday in February and end the first Wednesday after the first Monday in May. So with the shortened time on both ends, this session is almost a week shorter than some other short sessions have been. So everything is sort of is crunched, and our deadlines for committees and everything else are sort of truncated this year. So we're on a faster treadmill than usual.
So really every second of your time counts during this time period. So we are so grateful for the time that you're taking to speak with us today. And we know that the Senate has really picked up on some pretty important educational issues this session. So we're really excited to hear a little bit more about that and talk about that. So I think I know we have SB 1 out there. Do you want to share a little bit about that and, you know, how that's looking?
Yes, SB 1, as the number might indicate, is the major priority for our Senate Democratic Caucus this year. And it has a lot of components related to education. It is pending in the Education Committee. I just spoke with Senator McCrory about it this morning. It's on target and has a number of components, many of which are related to concerns that have developed since the pandemic. We know that children have been gravely affected by that. We know that there have been gaps in learning. We know that children who have been out of school and learning virtually, that has been uneven. It has worked well for some and certainly not well for others. Same has been true of teachers trying to cope with that as well.
Uneven is an excellent characterization. You're the first person who said it to me that way. And uneven is an excellent characterization that, you know, of how that experience has been felt by everybody.
Right. But one of the things we want to do in the bill is to enhance resources for schools, for children, to make sure that counseling opportunities are enhanced for children within the schools. That's a significant problem that we have found out, that mental health problems for children, for students have been exacerbated during the pandemic. And there is a real treatment gap. We know in many cases that students have great difficulty getting treatment outside of school. Clearly, they have school counselors who do a terrific job. But in cases where the need is greater, it's very difficult sometimes to connect with a child psychologist, psychiatrist, or licensed clinical social worker. In many cases, they don't take insurance. And when they do take insurance, it's only part of what the actual cost is. And one of the components of Senate Bill 1 is to find ways to enhance the number of counselors in the schools to deal with children.
Excellent.
And to make sure there are greater resources available in school, as well as helping to connect better with the professionals who work in settings outside of school.
And I think that's so important because I think sometimes people who aren't involved in schools don't necessarily know the role that school psychologists, social workers, and school counselors play in supporting student learning. You know, it's not just services to kids. It's evaluations for special education. Right. It's social groups for kids who might be going through something difficult, life change. There are so many different aspects to what supports those professionals give, and having more of them is really an important aspect to what we do in our schools.
Oh, absolutely. It's something that teachers have had to adjust to, that parents and children have had to adjust to. And it really, if you think about it, I think about my 4-year-old granddaughter. She doesn't really have many pre-pandemic memories at this point. She was only 2 when it started. Her older sister, Anna, who is 7, you know, has a more historical perspective, and her world is divided into before the germs and after the germs.
Well, and I think, you know, for a lot of us, that's actually, I think, becoming a benchmark moment, right? I think when we think about our history of our lives, this is certainly a moment that I think is going to live, and the impact is significant. And I do think we have seen a surge in our schools of students who need support. And one of the things that we know is, you know, I know as a high school teacher, when I'm in a classroom with kids, I worry about them. And if I can't figure out how to get them the services they need, I can't figure out where to access those things, that's a worry I carry with me. And so knowing that we're moving in a direction that opens doors, provides more opportunities, provides more resources, I think really makes not just the world for the kids better, but it actually makes everybody's life a little bit better because we can do the business of educating when those needs are met. And I think that's really a really powerful statement for the Senate to take this up. I know we've talked to the Education Committee, given testimony. So we're excited to see those things move forward because I do think those are big impact items. And when you talk about a short session, big impact in a short session, I think mental health is a key element to that. Are there other things that you're looking forward to kind of having the opportunity to discuss and bring forward?
Yes. One of the other things we're looking at, in addition to the various components of Senate Bill 1, is dealing with the issue of special ed costs reimbursement.
Oh,
we
yes.
know that is a huge problem in every district because sometimes a very expensive special ed case, the family may move into the district and
right.
all of a sudden there they are with a service need that has to be met and they weren't there a couple of months earlier
right.
and yet there they are. So, and of course, the current system is that a district has to spend 4.5 times the per person expenditure that they make before any state assistance kicks in and the excess cost is not fully funded. It's only funded about 68%.
Yep.
So I have a bill, Senate Bill 232, which would try to focus on that problem and to provide greater resources, especially to the districts that really don't have yep. the financial resources or the robust grand list to cope with those
right.
extra expenditures. And modeling it somewhat on the pilot reimbursement program that we passed last year to
mm-hmm.
to create three tiers of municipalities, those that have grand list net per capita under 100,000 and those
yep.
between 102 and then 203, and to have a greater reimbursement for special ed costs to the districts that have less capacity to fund those services. So there are several different components of this and ways to approach it, but that's one of our other commitments this year is to find some way to address the excess cost issue that has really been underfunded for a significant period of time and is a real
Good.
Problem for districts in trying to budget.
Yeah, I mean, I think anytime you have these unpredictable costs, right, that starts to make things very difficult. And we feel that as educators, because it impacts staffing, it impacts the ability to even bargain our salaries successfully when we have unpredictable costs that our districts are navigating. And so when we look kind of at the climate and the landscape of educator life, those sorts of things are really important for a district to have, you know, resources and understand what allocations are available. Because as you said, often, you know, the best laid plan can quickly go out the window. And we don't want to have barriers for students getting the support that they need. We want there to be access and it to not be a zip code situation, right? We want it to be, regardless of where you are, you have the access to the same quality resources. So I applaud you ambitiously embarking on anything that has to do with special education and resource allocation.
Well, and I do think that the investment on the front end, I know it seems like a huge price tag or a cost, but I think when you look at the consequences to underfunding special education,
right.
You know, it's pretty severe, not just in the students' lack of access to supports and resources, but just, you know, down the line with other costs that come with not providing the supports up front. So I think it's a really smart endeavor and something that needs to happen. So we appreciate that as well.
Yeah, we would argue with you that education is always a solid investment. You know, and I probably not against you, but with, you know, I think we stand on pretty similar ground in that capacity.
Oh, I think so. One of the things that I always try to argue when I go out and talk with citizens groups, especially in the smaller towns, suburban towns, when they vote on their school budgets, obviously
mm-hmm.
in the larger cities, you don't have that. And it's the city council's board of alders and the mayor that do it. But in the small towns where budgets are voted on, I always point out to people, you know, it's in your interest to have a robust school system.
Right.
And it always seems to me that in some cases, older people especially become sensitive to cost only and they want to cut costs. But they are at some time going to be selling their home and
Correct.
Moving perhaps to a senior housing or some less expensive place. But if their town has a reputation of having a really high quality school system, the value of their home is enhanced by that.
Right.
And the marketability of it to a young family looking for a district to move into that has a quality school system is that you have to take the long view on those things.
Right.
Supporting an education budget is part of the long view that people should take, that
mm-hmm.
it's in everyone's interest, including the current taxpayers.
Oh, 100%. I always say that education to me is not just foundational in terms of human growth. It's also a foundation in economic growth. Because if we talk about businesses coming to the state of Connecticut and wanting to thrive and grow here, they have to have families that want to live and work and be in this state. And therefore, you want to be attractive. You want to have the resources that people are like, yes, I want to be in Connecticut because they have great schools and my kids will do really well here. And you look at some of the transitional aspect of our economy in that regard. And this is a key and important factor in drawing people into the state and feeling like, you know, yeah, our cost of living maybe isn't as low as we would like it to be, but there's so much else we have to offer. And that's where our education really does start to kind of be a nice shining beacon.
Well, that's right. Because if you based everything only on cost, the world would be beating a path to Mississippi and Arkansas.
Correct.
The two lowest cost states in the country. And that's not happening because there are other issues that about quality of life, quality of school system, quality of public services,
right,
that lead people to live elsewhere and are willing to pay more for those services.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as we look at sort of the economics of this, the governor's budget and all of that, you know, it's nice to see that we finally put some money behind the indoor air quality issue. We're really excited in this legislative session to see not only has the governor kind of yielded that this is not just important to talk about, it's important to kind of take action with. But we're really feeling that sentiment bipartisan as we have these conversations with the sort of different legislators. So we're happy to see that. Have you been seeing the same? Please tell us that you have, that it hasn't all been a facade on our side.
No. I was talking with Senator McCrory, our education chair, about that just this morning. The governor has proposed spending for HVAC systems. But the other thing we need to look at, and I know Senator McCrory is thinking about having a group set up to study this or to mandate municipalities to regularly report on their maintenance. This has been one of the problems,
right,
we've seen in New Haven and other systems, is that, you know, the state of Connecticut spent over $12 million over the years on the $15 million school construction program in New Haven, or rather, I mean, $1.2 billion out of the $1.5 billion program. And it was over 80% state funding. But we're hearing that many problems in some relatively new buildings are coming up because regular maintenance was not done.
Right.
And that replacing filters on a timely basis would have prevented problems that now require expensive repairs.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that the school districts in some cases have not been vigilant in monitoring and maintaining the facilities that were largely paid for by the state. And certainly in urban districts, the state is paying more than 80% of the cost.
Right.
So I know Senator McCrory, who is from Hartford, is also sensitive to that and wants to have some component of greater accountability so that that maintenance schedules are maintained so you don't have problems occurring that could have been avoided just if regular maintenance and changing of filters and things of that nature,
right,
had been done.
Well, it's funny that you almost have to mandate that maintenance, right? Because I think in lieu of a standards or a rule, most places try to get away with, well, if I don't have to spend that money on that, we can put it X in this location or in this location. And I don't think it's just the large municipalities, because we were at a Board of Ed meeting, and I'll leave the district's name out of it, but it was the elementary school that I actually went to as a child, and it had not been repaired since probably before that. And it's been a few decades since I've been in elementary school. And so, you know, this was a well-funded district that just didn't prioritize maintenance. And so now we've got repairs and probably disrepair,
yeah,
right?
That sewage backing up, like things that shouldn't be happening,
you know,
in schools.
In that district, because of the lack of maintenance, you know, it probably is going to end up costing them so much more money than it would have in the long run just to put those regular checks in.
That's right. Because all of a sudden now that's become a front and center issue with everyone is concerned about air quality, air,
yep,
circulation, and everything else that's now people are sensitive to. And that's one of the issues where districts are going to be held accountable from now on and should have been for a long time.
Well, and I think you're right. You know, it's an issue whose time has come. We've been sort of banging that drum for quite some time.
Yes.
And talking about, you know, the quality of these buildings and the quality of life in them matters. It matters in terms of the ability for us to do the instruction that we want to, you know, done, to for the students to be able to learn the way we want them to be able to learn. And I also think it's a value statement, right? It's a value statement. You walk by a school that's falling apart or in disrepair, there's a sense that this community doesn't care about itself. You walk by the, you know, brand new schools where there's been an investment and there's a sense, oh, wow, okay, we've doubled down here. So, I mean, I think it does matter. And it seems like we would hope people would do the right thing, but we find often that people may want to do the right thing, but do often the easy thing.
That's right. And I think it's important for people to know that when the state spends money on bonding, whether it be for education or for some other purpose, the state is not just paying the cost of that project, but is paying the debt service for 20 or 30 years thereafter. So that $1.2 billion for the City of New Haven School Construction Program is $1.2 billion multiplied several times because of 20 or 30 years of debt service on that initial borrowing. So it's a major, major commitment that the state makes whenever it bonds for any purpose.
Well, and I do think that, you know, I think that is important for people to understand, because often these conversations start to talk in numbers that your average citizen is like $1.2 billion, you know, but I think even if I can't comprehend $1.2 billion, which is very large, I can understand the concept of the debt, right? You know, those of us who have taken out mortgages, those of us who have taken out car loans, that's what we're talking about here, is the basic fundamental of it's not just that the money has been granted, it's that the repayment of that process has
been owned. A $200,000 mortgage pays a lot more than $200,000 over the life of the mortgage.
Absolutely. Well, Senator, we are so happy that you're here. I'm going to ask you one more thing. We've been talking about how do we acknowledge teachers during the pandemic? How do we acknowledge the fact that there's really, in some cases, just no words to describe what the last 2 years has been like for educators? And I know we've talked a little bit about seeing if there's a means to acknowledge it through a TRB kind of attribute where we could earn additional service for that time. And we're working out all, you know, this always is a numbers game, right? It's a numbers game. I acknowledge that. But what do you think about being able to pursue that kind of idea?
Well, I think that's critically important and a matter of equity. For those who are, like teachers, covered by a pension plan, I think that might be a way to pursue it, to give additional pension credits for those who are on the front lines and were exposed to the risks of the pandemic and were teaching and were meeting with students at a time when there was great risk. And I think that that would be a way to approach it. For other frontline workers, for other first responders who may not be covered by pensions, then we've got to find some other way to assist them. But I think for those who are in a pension plan, some additional credits in that area would certainly be a way to acknowledge their service and what they did above and beyond the call of duty.
I think it would go a long way with educators if something like that were to come forward, because I think they love what they do and they appreciate any level of support. But this would be a tremendous step forward in saying we really do appreciate you and we really do see the toll that these 2 years took on educators. And for those who don't know, it does take a teacher in Connecticut 37 and a half years to actualize on their full pension. So it is a significant amount of time and commitment to the career. So a year or two of
every
extra
little
credit
bit helps.
might be good. You know, that we have other careers that take far less time to actualize their pensions.
Right.
And so that's just a little tidbit out there for anybody who did not recognize how long it does take for an educator to put in their time.
Well, Senator, we thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that we can have you back. Maybe, you know, after this session, we can reflect on what's next, because I think we know in a short session, we're probably not going to get everything we want, but we will have made some gains and know what the future holds. So hopefully we'll be able to have you back.
I would love to come back. We can do a reflection on what actually did pass in the session and what we're also looking forward to doing next year that we may not be able to get to this year.
And we'll have more time.
Absolutely.
We'll have more time.
Good.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We want to thank all of our members for all you do and for listening to the latest edition of Two Teas in a Pod.
For more education talk, subscribe to Two Teas in a Pod and find us at CEA.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Like what you heard? Share a podcast with your friends and colleagues and spread the word, because we are
stronger together.